You're listening to Decay Mag Sessions. Exclusive interview. David Reardon.
The desert, unchanged for millions of years, yet witness to a biblical prophecy come true that one day the meek shall inherit the earth.
On June 8, 2017, I interviewed filmmaker Marco Macchiasco and thus began our coverage of It Came From the Desert. On May 21st, 2018, I interviewed lead actress Vanessa Grass on her role in It Came From the Desert. On Wednesday, June 6, 2018, I connected and concluded coverage to the film in our interview with David Reardon, developer of the game to which the film is based on. According to IMDb, Reardon serves as director, writer, producer for video game content, with credits beginning in the early 90s. In addition, Reardon worked in television, serving as documentary producer before starting his career on interactive media. Reardon served as an advisor for Lucasfilm. His skills in media also entered the audio production spectrum. Reardon boasts a number one hit back in the 70s. It Came From the Desert, released on May 29, 2018, and the synopsis to the film reads as follows. A pulpy action monster movie inspired by CinemaWare's cult 1980s video game It Came From the Desert. A nostalgic tribute to creature features from the 1950s. It Came From the Desert features rival motocross heroes and heroines. Kegger parties in the desert. Secret underground military bases. Romantic insecurities, and of course, giant ants. In our interview with Mr. Reardon, we discussed the various aspects of video game development, as well as the inspiration for the film It Came From the Desert, based on the video game Reardon created years ago. Also note that in the pioneering years of video games, many experimentations were in place, and It Came From the Desert is a video game that allows players to have a story narrative character rich in character development. And we could see this in modern games such as The Walking Dead from Telltale, in which the players draw their fate by selecting dialogue and intricate cutscenes that revolve around their choices. In any event, without further ado, here is our interview with Mr. David Reardon.
I'm just gonna jump right into the interview, and I always start out the interview with providing the interviewee with an opportunity to deliver an origin story, a bit about yourself, your career so far, leading up to your latest work. The floor is open.
Hi, everybody. It's David Reardon, and I'm a storyteller, always have been. And I started out in the music business and made records and all of that, and then segued to the film business and did all of that. And then when new technology came along in the early 1980s that allowed us to start thinking about interactive movies and games, I moved into that as a storyteller because I just thought it was fascinating that you would give the audience some choice in how they would navigate through a particular authored body of material. So I spent 15 years, and I was lucky enough to be sort of at the first wave of that, which included all the early game machines and computers and such. It now is the game business, which is a $65 billion business that we only imagined in those days. But the other thing that happened in that particular place, and really as it relates to it came from the desert sort of place and all that, is that as we move from linear storytelling to interactive storytelling, there were just all kinds of things that were different. We had to evolve tools for actually editing all this stuff, and so that we actually could get much more sophisticated stories as time went on. So that was a lot of work that went on in a lot of places like Disney and Time Warner and Philips. And then so that was a whole piece. And then I've been for the last 15 years doing really documentary media. We call it transmedia these days just because it has so many different forms, from television to web to now with the new piece, virtual reality, which is a new technology that actually we've been looking at since the 70s, but now it's becoming something. And that's of real interest when we talk about immersive experiences as a result of actually putting the helmet on and taking you into worlds that we couldn't imagine otherwise. So that's pretty much a quick summary of where I am. And as I said, as it relates to It Came from the Desert, desert was a pivotal piece for me. And then also it brought a certain amount of ingenuity to the whole quality of what were considered games and interactive movies of that type. So when Marco did his film, It Came from the Desert, so many years later, it's been a real joy to be working with them and watch them actually capture the spirit of the game.
Thank you for that piece. And It Came from the Desert right now, it's on video on demand, and it adapts, as you had mentioned, the game so well there. And there are also some Easter eggs. I had watched the commentary that you have provided about the history of the video game itself. Did you actually foresee the video game industry morphing to what it is right now?
I don't think anybody did. I mean, you have hopes, I guess, that, because I was coming out, or, what I had done prior to that was music and film, like I said. And those are very big global audiences. So it's really fun to create things, which I did as a producer and director and as a musician, for very large audiences. Because when something actually resonates with an audience, it just goes worldwide and it's really fun to play with and it has great influence and so on. So I think when this business came along, I'm not sure what we thought of it. I mean, the technology was so crude when in the beginning, and really up through when I, even 15 years later, compared to what we have now, it was, we could only dream about what is happening now, because we look at things like it's a fully integrated medium with, film quality graphics in a continuous environment, as opposed to what we were doing, which was actually sort of trying to merge video that we would shoot against green screen with digital graphics and make a game out of it. So it was crude in comparison to what it is now. I think the dream that everybody had is that, sort of hasn't come true, but it's not really a surprise, is that I think all of us were really interested in lots of different forms of interactive stories. And basically, as the game business then emerged out of all of this, and this is going to be a big generalization, but it is mostly these days action shooters or action adventure. There are a few narrative tales where you may be a detective trying to figure something out. And then sports is the other big category. And those were just two of many categories that we were playing with. They've really now become the categories. And when I, look at the size of this business in terms of the combat simulators and all the mythical, God games and things like that, I think we would have liked to have seen all that great technology used in different ways, not just in those ways. But look, this is what happens and this is what has happened. So you can't argue with it.
Absolutely. And now the game industry is evolving into esports, e-competitions. And personally, I foresee in the upcoming 10 years, real sports is going to be put in the back burner and audiences are going to be tuning into esports competitions, which is mind-boggling, watching players interact with these virtual characters.
Yeah, and that's a great point. That is something that even until recently, I wouldn't have predicted that. And I'll tell you just a quick story. And this is actually how I found Marco, because I've been out of the business for so long. I really wasn't aware in the earlier stages when he was thinking about doing the film. And so I'm at a place where I wanted to sort of collect some of my work. And certainly It Came from the Desert was one of them. But one of the things that we see is that they were built for certain systems at that point. There's no, like, music translated from, you know, vinyl records to CDs to digital files. So the music that I made, always up to date, you know, given the current technology. But that's not true of games. They were designed for, you know, certain platforms that don't exist anymore. Even though you can get versions of them on the new, they're just not the same. So I was lamenting that I was going to have to, when I was thinking about Desert and wanting to go back and look at some of the footage and pull some of it out for some of my legacy project, is that I was going to have to set up an Amiga, which I didn't have anymore. So I'd have to go get one and then actually, you know, play the game and capture the video at the back. And one of my editors, actually, this is how stupid I am, even though we work in social media all the time, he said, you know, we ought to take a look at YouTube because there's a lot of games on YouTube. And I said, why would they be on YouTube other than people, you know, I mean, and he said, well, actually people are playing them and putting them all up. And then, as you pointed out, the extension of that is that people are actually watching people play games now, whether it's sports or anything. That part, I don't think anybody would have, you know, calculated that people would actually do that. But I was thankful because it turned out the entire It Came from the Desert game, all three versions in multiple different ways, was up on YouTube. And so we just could sample the footage off of that. It saved us a lot of work. And in that process is when I saw the trailer, the early trailer for the It Came from the Desert movie that Marco had done. And I said, oh my God, somebody's actually made a movie of the game. And then we got connected. And then, you know, we've been talking since then.
Yeah, it's amazing time they were in. And you mentioned social media. I wouldn't expect that myself. And I was an avid gamer until a few years ago. It's just, wow, amazing. People actually sitting down, people making a living playing games. It's incredible.
Yeah. And becoming celebrities and, you know, all these. I mean, there were competitions, you know, where people would, you know, like Electronic Arts was, you know, when they were in the heyday, they would, you know, put these festivals together and games that we had done for them would be there and people would play them and there would be, you know, competitions and so on, but nothing like this. And really nothing like people watching somebody actually play or looking at video files on YouTube is where I see it. That part, I'm probably showing my age, but I just in wonderment about why people do it. But as I said, I was thankful because I actually, not just with Desert, but with all the hits that I'd had, all the footage was there. So I saw things in the games that I had completely forgotten about for years. So I was really appreciative of the fact that they played it all the way through.
Well, thank goodness for that. And yeah, it came from the Desert. Interesting concept. Once again, I'm going to refer to the commentary that you provided behind the game. Given the tools, let's say in the situation that we are now today, do you find It Came from the Desert will garner a new audience with the technologies that we have and the storyline?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I'm absolutely amazed that all these years later that Marco made a movie out of it. So I couldn't have predicted that. I mean, right. But immediately because, you know, what I liked about what he did is that my first thought was, this is just actually weird in some way, is that because we made a game of a movie that I grew up with, which was Them, which was the classic big bug movie, 1954. I probably saw it in the late 50s or something as a kid. And I'd always remembered it. And you know, as I said in my other thing, it wasn't particularly scary to me, but it was really kind of campy and fun. And the ants were just horribly cheesy and all the rest of that. But it actually was a very serious movie about our fear of nuclear power and had we unleashed something, you know, that we couldn't control and all of that. So we actually made a game of that movie that had the sense of humor that I felt watching the movie. And so when Marco made his movie, he captured the humor of it. I mean, the first trailer that I saw is whoever is doing this understands the humor of the game. But then as we got into it, obviously Marco had his own story and it's updated to 2018. So here's the one thing that I will say that I always notice is that there are actual characters in the movie using cell phones to talk to each other. Well, mm-hmm. In 1980, we had none of that. And in fact, when you look at any of the monster movies or anything coming from outer space, what are people doing? They're looking actually for a payphone to tell people about it.
Right. Oh, yeah, that's true.
I mean, it's a giggle because now, you know, you see something and basically you make a video of it and it's around the world in like 5 seconds as opposed to, you know, this trying to find a phone booth and call authorities and all the rest of that. So I thought he did a really good job in sort of updating all of that and sort of getting the motorcycle culture, which is certainly wasn't around in the 80s with, you know, people doing races out in the desert and so on. I thought all of that, you know, was great. So the question would be, and certainly it was on my mind when I started to think about it, is that if there could be a movie called It Came from the Desert in 2018, what would stop us from doing a new version of the game, but basically update the story to what we might perceive as the current threats, right. You know, which were nuclear power then, not that we're not feeling threatened by that with all the North Korea stuff now.
Oh yeah.
But ultimately we have other threats on the horizon, and the biggest one that's talked about, although I think it's overblown, is the whole notion of artificial intelligence, that we're actually creating something that eventually we won't be able to control. And then we've all seen the movies about what happens with that, right? We don't fare well and all of that. Right, so I think something could be done. And I think, you know, big creatures are always sort of classic. And the fact that it came from the desert all these years later is still talked about a lot in the retro game press. Or not a lot, maybe it's mentioned and people say, yeah, that was my favorite game and so on. Yeah, I think there could be a new version. And this is when I look at the technology now and I see this seamless digital movie quality environment. I wouldn't that be fun to play with that technology with the big bugs and a new story and all the rest of it. So yeah, I think it could be an updated story. I don't think it could be the 50s story because I think that's long gone, but I think there could be a version in 2018.
Well, yeah, that would be something to look forward to. And relating to what you had mentioned earlier, there don't seem to be a lot of storytelling in video games. Most gamers are interested in the instant gratification with the first-person shooters. I particularly appreciate a good survival horror story, intricate characters, yep. Intricate plot. I actually sit through the whole cutscenes myself. With that said, how would a modern storytelling with the current landscape that we had in our world climate, what would be the social commentary you would present?
You mean in terms of if we did a new It Came from the Desert, what would be the social commentary?
Yes.
Well, I've said a little bit of it. We live in very interesting times.
You can say that again.
and when you look at what we're doing, I mean, I'll just pick on artificial intelligence just because it's a story I'm deep into at the moment. And what I say about it after having worked around and talked to, you know, a lot of the people that are developing this is that there is actually nothing artificial about it. I mean, we call it artificial intelligence because it sort of got named that at a certain point. But it's not. It actually is the next step of our intelligence that we are inventing and putting into algorithms as they are working now. This is not something in the future. We're putting them into potential robots. We're putting them into every smart device in the world is going to have some form of AI that is tracking something. And when you look at all of that, you just say, well, this is the next step in our intelligence. Now, the question of whether it would ever get out of control, to me, is almost a distraction because there's so many other interesting questions to ask before then. And most experts are saying it'll be a while, even if you look at the singularity work with Ray Kurzweil or any of that. You know, they're still saying 2045 or 50, maybe this happens, and, you know, we'll see, right? But there are all kinds of forms of this artificial intelligence. Some are embedded chips in us. Some of them are standalone algorithms and all that. So, but I think in all of that, there's the same question that we had about nuclear power. And literally, when you go back and you look at the tests that we did, that we literally marched soldiers down to ground zero as after these things had gone off, without any understanding of really, apparently, of the radiation danger and all that. And that caused all kinds of problems with anybody that was around it for years to come and locations to come and so on. But I think there really was this question about, you know, what have we unleashed? And certainly all the scientists at the time were very concerned that if the bomb was going to be the only thing, then, you know, we literally could, for the first time, destroy ourselves on this planet. And that's still a threat. Obviously, we're still dealing with this at the moment. But I think they're larger, not, and I don't want to call them threats. I think they're just advances that it will, if anybody's looking at what's changing, you can, and someone said to me the other day, oh, let's imagine what was going to happen in 2050. And I said, there is no way to imagine that, because the next 5 years is probably about as far out as you can go, because the changes that we're already seeing and will see to continue to accelerate in terms of the sort of techno-disruptive world that we live in. These are going to be major changes. I mean, it's going to change work patterns. It's going to change how we do a lot of things. And there's some questions, you know, serious questions about weaponization of all that and all that. So, long way around in your question, I think there's something in that story that, in terms of where the ants came from, originally it was radiation that made them big. In the movie, as you know, with Marco, sort of went with DNA from aliens being spliced in, certainly an interesting thing in terms of intelligence. But I think artificial intelligence, because there are going to be bioforms of that, an enhancement of bioforms, including us, would be interesting to play with. And I think I wouldn't necessarily set it up as all evil. I think I would set it up with the possibility that you could actually make allies of it as well, or something like that. I'm thinking out loud here. So I think there could be an updated thing, and I think it's the same basic fear that we always have as humans, is are we creating something, or is there something out there that literally could take us out?
That is an interesting perspective. And much like the era in the 50s, 60s, right now, the mass fear, if we could just call it that, with the AI, artificial intelligence, it has to do mostly with things that it is not understood, because we have the conspiracy theory with transhumanism, and all that related topics. But without the AI, the logarithms, we would not have the advancements in video game platforms that we have right now.
Of course.
Some video games out there adapt. So if you're playing not too well, the game gets easier. If you're playing as an ace, more enemies come at you. Imagine that type of technology on a VR platform. It's wonderful. Yep. I look forward to that.
Yeah, and just to that point, with VR, there's a whole nother set of questions to be asked and are being asked by anybody that's thinking about it as storytellers, is that there's no question that, I mean, you know, it's kind of funny to watch all of this stuff happen with VR the last couple of years, because it, not that I want to say it's the same as sort of that burst that happened in the early 80s, and then by the end of the 80s, we were making things like Desert, and then by the 90s, it very quickly got very sophisticated and into full motion, you know. So what's interesting about VR is that there's no question that it is going to be used for travel applications or 360 video stuff. I mean, you can buy a $350 camera right now and editing software, and basically you can make 360. I was just at a conference yesterday where someone just plopped one of those things in the middle of the room, and they're going to now have a 360, you know, file of what happened there, right? There's no question about all that. And as always, any new technology, pornography is going to be huge. It always is. It's just something about mostly us men. But I'm thinking that there may be something else feminine here, but we'll see. All of that is going to happen. But it's there is another thing. And for where I'm seeing it right now is in the research labs, particularly where VR is being used for therapeutic situations. So one example would be, PTSD, which is being used to treat soldiers that are coming back with traumatic situations from combat in Iraq or Afghanistan or whatever. And this is kind of a big story because it's a major, major problem that we're sort of addressing and not addressing. And when I go to those labs, when I visit, you know, what the cutting edge people are doing, they have things that look like video games, but they're actually live combat simulators that they can plug up all kinds of different situations and basically recreate the traumatic situation that the soldier's having problems with and then gradually desensitize it over time, which is part of the treatment. And when I look at that stuff, what's happening there is that they're literally changing the state of the participant, right? So it's more than just storytelling or making choices or shooting something or whatever. It's actually changing the state of the brain so that it doesn't know the difference. I mean, that's the phrase that we all use around VR. The brain doesn't notice the difference between eventually at some point, but what is VR if it's done skillfully and the real world? It thinks it's in the real world, oftentimes like we do with dreams, mm-hmm. is that they seem just so real sometimes, right? That's interesting to me as a storyteller, because now we're really talking about an immersive experience that you were touching on that brings up all other kinds of possibilities about what do I do here rather than just make choices or shoot something or throw a pass in football or whatever. There's something else to that, and it's early yet, so I don't think anybody really has a handle on it, but that's what interests me about it.
Right. And we have covered the art of VR. It was a platform here in New York City. They were showcasing the various aspects of virtual reality from video games to film, and it's and even animations, which I found to be amazing. With that said, how do you see the film industry adapting to this new technology? So the box office hasn't been what it once was. You think Hollywood would adapt to this new platform sometime in the near future?
You know, I don't know, Ken. We went through in that course that I was talking about, which was sort of middle 80s to late 90s when I was doing most of my work there. Mm-hmm. There was always this thing, because I was working for major studios like Warner Brothers and Disney and so on. So they were always interested in the fact, could there be something in a theater, as an example, something in a what we would call location-based entertainment at the time, right? And there were experiments. Actually, some of them were really fun that were not theaters, but they were basically places where you went where there were pods. I remember one of them, and you'd get in the pod with a bunch of other people. You could do it as a party or, you know, whatever. And each of you controlled, you know, some kind of big, you know, mechanized war machine, right? And then you would go to war with each other in this thing, in this common environment, right? So, and now we have that in the virtual environment, so you don't need to go to a location-based thing unless you want to do one of those. So, but the problem, and so I think that there was something to do there. The problem for me is that it's such a different experience that any time that we tried, and I'm watching it now sort of with 3D in a certain sense, making a comeback and whatever, and everybody puts the glasses on and says, oh, or, you know, or you go to a ride like at Disney. I was very involved with the people that were, you know, Imagineering new rides, right, that would have 3D stuff. It just, for me, I think it's entertaining. I think it's fun in an amusement park and so on. But the problem is that just for me is that group experience just can't be what the individual experience can be. And that doesn't mean you and I couldn't be in the same environment. I'm just saying that I think that's morally going to happen virtually, you know, over the cloud with each of us with helmets on or, you know, however we can imagine that, or, you know, smart glasses or something. And I think there's something to do there. And I think there will be movies that attempt, or things that we call movies that, you know, that we watch or even experience, that will try to use it. But my guess is a lot like the way games were in the first go around, which, you know, we've been talking about, is that it actually became something really different. And it wasn't the same. So in a certain sense, it became its own medium. So you can look at it now and, you know, what is the game market? It's $65 billion. That's more than the film business.
Right? Yes, it is.
And so it became its own thing. It didn't try to keep mimicking interactive versions of movies where you had a few choice points. It became something totally different. And I think VR is going to do all the things that I said it was going to do, which are the obvious things. Like if you and I, I'll just do it from a film standpoint. If I'm looking at a certain location to go shoot in, the fact that I can use a VR technology to actually go walk around the location is 10 times better than me having to fly there and, you know, take pictures like we did in the old days. So all of that is going to happen. But there's something else here. Just like I felt there was something else when I saw the first interactive media stuff, I said, this is a medium in and of itself, and it has its own stuff, and it's going to become its own thing, which it did. And I think VR is going to be the same. I think that there's going to be something out of this that will be entirely new, that will be immersive and, as I said, state-changing in terms of your brain doesn't know the difference. You know, and then now if you're storytelling and with that technology, that's a really interesting proposition that I don't think anybody knows anything about at this point, but it's really exciting.
Yes, it's so true. And you mentioned looking in, someone asking you a question 50 years onto the future. You make an interesting point. We don't know what's going to happen in the next 5 years. Look at social media. Right. It just exploded in less than 10 years. Our mobile devices has more processing power than NASA did when they shot the rocket to the moon.
And it's accelerating. That's the other thing that we see about it, and you cover it, so you know this, but it's the speed of change is accelerating. I mean, so the time it takes to get to the next iteration of it, that it becomes something else, is much quicker. And there are billions of dollars being spent on artificial intelligence for all kinds of different reasons, including entertainment. And you know, who am I playing against? Who am I having a relationship with? And certainly in VR, the immersive experience of that, as opposed to just watching it even on a big screen TV, it's just different, you know. And as you said, as it starts to adjust to you, as it's smart enough to know, you know, to sort of like a real person would, in a way that it starts to develop a relationship with you, that it kind of knows your tendencies and is stretching you in certain sort of ways, that's a really interesting thing, you know, to play with. And from a storytelling standpoint of view, you were mentioning it's all shooters and sports or something. I think I said that as well. And that's a generalization, but I think it's, you know, generally true that that's the majority of it. But think about the stories that we could do that are relational within a VR environment, where there is actually a character that is growing with us through the experience. That's Brave New World stuff. It's fun to think about.
Absolutely. And creating it came from the desert. I know there was a lot of writing involved, getting the storylines in place. For both in film and from the video game sector, do you feel that storyline, plot, and character development is something that still needs to be focused on and not necessarily the eye candy?
I agree. I mean, I'm personally interested in that because that's what interests me. I mean, I like it to look good, and I think it's fun to have splashy environments like we're seeing in all the new games, that you can hardly tell the difference between that and the movie anymore. But I'm more drawn to small, sort of more intimate settings where you're really playing with some variables, and those variables have gotten and will get much more sophisticated as AI is employed in all of this, as the software gets smarter. But we saw that in the beginning, is that interactive started off so crude, sort of choose your own adventure, you know, that you could go to door A versus door B, right, as an example, and then something different would happen as a result. But those kinds of decision trees very quickly are very limited. So we really were looking at a much more fluid kind of database eventually, even in the time that, you know, up until late 90s, stuff was getting much more sophisticated in terms of knowing what you knew about the story and then presenting the obvious thing that would be presented to you based on you knowing that, right? And one of the things that happened to me early on was that we had these big testing departments, right? Because the games had to be tested to make sure that they did everything that they were supposed to do. And we then crossed the line into sophisticated software that actually you could not test all the variations. There were too many. And the first time that I had the experience of watching the software, the game, or a character, or whatever, do something that I never intended in the design, that was magic for me. I just said, wow. I don't know what added up to all this, but I've never seen it do that before. Right? Mm. And then that now you carry that on to where we are now, and then what's going to happen, and that's only going to get expanded, I think, way beyond where we are at the moment. So I think that if we're interested, like you say you are, me too, in more character-driven narratives, these are going to be immersive experiences now, where you're actually having a relationship that's going to grow over time. That's a completely different thing than, you know, I've got a big gun, I'm going to go shoot the alien.
Exactly. Well, that's entertaining in itself, but I'm more in tune with the with the character and the creatures and everything else that goes in along with the good story. And when I first covered It Came from the Desert, I interviewed Marco late last year. Uh-huh. And I wasn't too aware with the video game, and I saw the documentary, the mini doc that you did. I was like, oh, that's the game. I had a friend who actually had the game, and I remember the graphics, and also Thunder in Paradise. I remember that one too.
Yep. Well, and you can see, you know, from the mini doc that how fast that happened, right? That we went from Amiga graphics that at Cineware, even for Desert, that were, you know, minimal to say the least. I mean, what you could do and not, to full motion. I mean, first into Voyeur, which was sort of a combination of things that I always loved, and then full motion with Hulk and everybody at the, you know, Hogan doing, you know, Thunder in Paradise. Now, that all got transplaced, or you know, that all got replaced by the fact that you could now go to fully digital with all of that, which just solved a lot of the problems that we had with trying to integrate video and character, you know, and actors and all the rest of that with digital sequences that you would actually do things in. So that's all been solved. But that all happened, as I said in the mini doc, in about 5 years. I couldn't have imagined that it would have moved that quickly, but it did.
Yeah. And also, It Came from the Desert is one of those video games that provide the narrative, provided both a story, and you have the live actors. You had Hulk Hogan involved in Thunder in Paradise. And from there, do you find yourself to be one of the founding fathers of this type of medium that blended?
No, I mean, not
films?
Real. I was lucky enough to be a part of an industry that was new.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, and I went through the same thing in music. I mean, so when I was a kid, you know, late 60s, and I started writing songs, and then I eventually made records. The music business was not really didn't explode, although you could still make a lot of money in it, until about the mid 70s, and it became big business and tours, then MTV changed everything, right? That now you got a visual component to all the things, right? And I feel the same way about the interactive stuff, is there were just a lot of us that were interested in it and there and trying stuff. And we learned a lot from each other. We would, you know, because it was just such a wide open palette at that point because nobody really knew what they were doing. The desert in the end, I think, you know, was my contribution to that pool. But there certainly were a lot of people that, you know, made contributions to that whole art, you know, moving forward. I was just lucky enough to sort of be there at the right time and had some ideas that caught on, which was fun. But certainly I wasn't, you know, the only one or a small group of people. There were quite a few that were working it from all angles.
Interesting. And to close out our interview, the final two questions, one of them being for persons in indie game developers or writers, script writers, what advices you have for them, especially with the platforms and tools that we have at our disposal if they want to jump into creating content.
Yeah. You know, I know it. Here's one thing that's changed is that the nature of crowdfunding has changed everything, right? Mm-hmm. So, to a certain extent, when we started with all of this, I mean, Cinemaware, as I said, was a really small company. When I first got there, it ended up being big, almost bought by Sony, and then wasn't. And then, you know, and then on into Disney and Time Warner and all that for me. But you always worked for big companies because they had, you know, they had the money. Now, occasionally we would do an independent thing where we would go out and raise money like we would raise money for an independent film, you know, where you'd go get investors and, you know, whatever. Crowdfunding has changed all of that, and it's changed media, I think, in general. Not that it's any magic thing that you simply put something out there and everybody gives you money to go do it. You still need to have a good idea. You still need to have a big enough list that's interested in contributing to it. But you have much more independence, potentially, and particularly in the indie side of things. And I'm watching this in the VR as well, is that what interests me most is not the big companies that are doing or trying to do things with VR, and it's still early yet. I'm really interested in what's going on sort of in the indie scene with VR, mm-hmm. because that's where artists, young artists, are really asking really interesting questions about what is it good for, and then trying certain things and all that. So I guess my advice is always to anybody, you know, do something that you love, because you're going to run into nothing but challenges to try to get it done.
Exactly.
So on those dark days when everything seems to be going wrong, you better love it, and you better have a reason why you're doing it. Otherwise, it can be really depressing. But secondly, I think that because you can raise your own money now, which, you know, and not have to go convince somebody at one of the big studios or one of the big game groups, although that still happens, obviously, big business, to do whatever it is that you want to do that's original, you have access to, you know, develop an idea, then get it out through the press. And, you know, I know of instances where, you know, people have really done that and done extremely well. So I would, if I was doing it at a younger age again, like I was, that's an interesting proposition. And then I would say, what is the thing that I want to make? I don't want to just go parrot the next war game or the next shooter or the next sports game. I want to do something else than that that's more interesting. I think this is a time when that can happen.
Oh, absolutely. I agree. This is the era of, this is the thinking outside the box era.
You bet.
And
yeah, and you can get people to go along with you. That's the cool thing. I mean, it's, you go to a big studio, even in the big game, in video game companies, there's so much money on the line for them that you understand, just like movie companies that continue to turn out the next Marvel movie or the next Star Wars movie or whatever. These are the big franchises that fund all that stuff, right? So they're just much less likely to do something that is really interesting and kind of edgy, you know, or in terms of something new. But now there's a market for indie stuff, in games in particular. And then I think we're seeing this in VR, where you really can experiment with new things and find an audience that will support you.
Oh, absolutely. And with that is, if it's science fiction or horror, and horror in particular, go for stuff that people want to experience and enjoy. People enjoy the fright factor. People want to see a scary portrait of an alien or a technology infused into the storyline. The time is out there to create something worthwhile.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I would go even a step further. For me, I'm not saying everybody should do this, but mm-hmm. One of the things that I look at with my contemporaries now, because we look at what stories are we telling about the now and the future, right? And it doesn't take too long to figure out that a lot of our films and television and video games are very dystopian in nature. They're very dark about mm-hmm. what the future is going to be like. And I understand that. I mean, we're hardwired to think that way, in a sense. We're always looking for the next threat, and how could we blow ourselves up, and how could we be that stupid, and so on. And it certainly is entertaining, because there's a lot of drama involved. But there needs to be people step up at this point to create things that can be very dramatic and exciting to play and experience, that are more about what are the possibilities of where we can go. Now, we see this in science fiction a bit, where, and Star Trek is a good example, that Gene, you know, originally, you know, created a world that he could deal with a lot of subjects like racism or gender or whatever in quotes, an alien advanced world. And so we, you know, it made it on the networks. They never could have done that had they done it as a contemporary story. And so science fiction, you know, forms, has that function. It allows us to go imagine things, and Star Wars as well and all the rest of it. The only, and I think that's fine. I'm more interested in what's between now, where we are now, and the future, in all the good work that is going on that hasn't quite surfaced yet, that actually points toward a more generative future rather than a dystopian future, which is much easier for us to imagine. And so for me, that's the challenge. As I get into this, and particularly with the VR stuff, I start thinking about stories where you could actually have an experience of that, because I think it's the hardest thing for us to imagine is how could it actually be a better, more generative world as opposed to we're slipping into some dystopian version of Blade Runner or Children of Men or Hunger Games, you know, take your pick, right?
Right.
And I want to do that as a contemporary story as opposed to placing it in a science fiction world, which I think is fine, and I'm glad people are doing that. But I think there's a certain disconnect that we say, well, that's in that world. We could never do that. And I think, well, that's not true. So let's see what we can figure out here.
That's a very interesting perspective. Wow.
Thank you.
Didn't think of it that way. It is true.
It doesn't take long to figure it out. And listen, I'm not being critical. I'm a fan of a lot of these, you know, franchises, particularly as we look at the serial television episodes now that are, or series that are happening on Netflix and Amazon, because they're transforming what creators can do, right? Lana Wachowski, who's part of our integral community, you know, who did The Matrix and V for Vendetta and all that, was just so thankful to be able to go and do Sense8 in a serial thing, because her movies were just too big. When you looked at them, you just said, they're just gigantic. There's just not enough time to cover all these characters and all the things that she wanted to say. And so with the serial, two seasons of Sense8, she was able to fully explore that, and we end up binge watching it, you know, and it turns out to be a really interesting, you know, experiment. So in all of that, I'm not saying that I want to work with some, you know, kind of gooey utopian view of what the future might bring, which we all know probably won't. But I'm actually interested in how we get from here to there and in real time. And there's so much good work and so many people, thought leaders that are playing in all kinds of different areas that could inform that. That interests me. And it particularly interests me when you can give someone an experience of that, like through VR, rather than just watching it like you would a movie.
Matt, those statements were an eye-opener.
Well, thanks. I'm just plugging away. You know, and there are a bunch of us that are playing with this idea. So.
Oh, I'm sure. And with that said, the final question for this interview is, what if you could share? Are projects that you have in the works?
Well, ones I can talk about.
Right.
There's a bunch of stuff I can't talk about, but I can talk about them generally. So we're looking at a VR application that actually has to do with relationships, and that's all I will say about it. But you and I have been talking about, you know, different stories that you can do with VR and have an experience of something rather than just watching it. So we're in the midst of that, and we're partnering with some of the research labs that I told you about, because they have interesting platforms and technology that they're using for therapy that I think actually could be adapted for storytelling. I do want to, around this last subject that I was talking about, we will convene a group of storytellers, and that'll include a lot of young people too, out of the VR work that's going on, and thought leaders, to sort of get at this question: why is it that what we can imagine about the future is so dystopian, and what could we do differently than that? And then come up with some ideas about how that media might come out into the world. So those are two things that I'm after at the moment. And then, as I said, I'm really interested in what's going on in artificial intelligence. So I'm doing just a whole series of interviews with, you know, people that are experts and the ones sitting in the lab spending all this money doing things. And they have some very interesting stories about what they think they're doing, right? And recently in that, well, recently is last year, the question actually got raised by a very interesting group of researchers around the world, which included some, you know, most of the top people globally. They started to ask this question about artificial intelligence, is what it would be a beneficial artificial intelligence. They actually had a conference in California in the middle of last year, and all of that work is going forward. And that's a fascinating conversation that is going on in the Valley right now about, well, we can certainly disrupt things with technology, but do we have any responsibility for the disruption we're causing? So basically, if we're going to, here's one aspect of it. If we're going to create technologies that are going to unemploy a whole lot of people, which is by anybody's standard is going to happen. It's already happening in a variety of ways. When you think people are pissed off now about not having jobs, as we look at Trump go on and on about how he's going to make America great again, you haven't seen nothing yet. I mean, five years from now, they're really going to be out of work. And so, you look at that and you start to say, all right, so is there any responsibility there? And if so, what does that mean? How does this get deployed? Or do we just have no responsibility whatsoever? We just disrupt the community and they're on their own about figuring that out. So that's an interesting conversation that I'm tracking with a whole bunch of interviews that I'm doing right now. And I don't have any magic answers because it's a very complex question. But at the same time, I would like to see the benefits of what we are creating, which is there's no question that we're going to do everything we're talking about and more in terms of AI. But I want to see the value of that spread to more people and not just be another technology that basically concentrates more wealth in a smaller and smaller group of people, which is what we're seeing culturally right now globally. And that movie that we've all seen, we've seen that movie, right?
Right.
And that doesn't end well for anybody when
Absolutely.
That happens.
Right.
Eventually, people get ticked off enough that they light the torches and they climb over whatever walls have been built around the people with privilege, and it doesn't end well for them. So I would encourage everybody to sort of think about, be a part of the future, don't be a part of the past.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Wow. So another eye-opener right there.
Well, if you want to talk about any of that on another day, we can. But yeah, so thank you, Ken. I really appreciate your questions. They're good ones. And let's hope that that this all helps get Marco's film out into the public and everybody loving it, because I think it's just great fun. I think he did a great job.
Oh, yeah, he did a fantastic job. And Creature Features, reinvigorating a bygone era, which... within the 50s and all these mutated things, it's a different pace, especially in the independent horror scene. Everything gets taken too seriously. It's a good film to watch and have popcorn with your friends with.
And the last thing I'll say is one of the things that I loved about Shape of Water, right,
mm-hmm.
was that he actually took a different tack on the monster, even though he paid, a lot of, he gave a lot of juice to what we do with monsters in films and in television. But his monster actually was intelligent to a certain extent, or a different intelligence, I should say. And that made the story just much more interesting to me than just having something that was chasing us all about and ripping our heads off when we got too close. That's interesting. And to our point about what would it be like to interact with a character like that, would we recognize its intelligence? That's the stuff that I would love to play with.
Right. And that's an aspect in storytelling that it's untapped. What happens if, you know, the big spaceship lands in the White House? How would religion react?
Well, and then you have all the conspiracy stories saying that's already happened, actually, and the government is in secret relationships with whatever, and they're just trying to get us, all of us, just trying to get us ready to accept that. And that's why we see so many films about aliens and our relationship to them and what they do and don't do, and, you know, differences between Independence Day, where they just came shooting, and other things like, I thought Shape of Water was interesting. There were a bunch of films. The Arrival is another one, which took a totally different tact on what happens when a superior intelligence shows up and starts acting in ways we don't understand. All of that's really interesting. So we'll see where all that goes.
Absolutely. Great conversation. Thank you for all this rich information.